Chapter 10.
I will thank you for an end to this wholly inappropriate interference, Mr. Lawrence, Rankin said icily. You have neither rank nor office, nor even proper training to recommend your opinion on the matter. Mr. Drewmore, I trust you are ready to stand the duty. Mr. Blinken, I believe you are next in seniority, should Mr. Drewmore fail to secure the hatchling. You will prepare yourself as well.
Yes, sir, Lieutenant Drewmore said after a moment, not displeased, but only slow to grasp the offered advantage. A man of 40, heavy of body and of mind at once, he had shown not an iota of initiative, which Lawrence had seen, and set himself apart only by a certain amiable willingness and basic competence. He had reached the rank of first lieutenant aboard a middleweight for no greater accomplishment than being the son of a distinguished and well-liked captain. But he had been grounded by the death of his beast during the plague, and no equal post had been offered him. And Blinken, only a little second to him in both years and seniority, was similarly a nonentity, neither of them in any way worthy of the one, the last egg. Meanwhile, Forthing, who alone among the aviators had distinguished himself in service, however meagre his connections, was evidently to be set aside. Lawrence had grown up in a service where influence was very nearly all in the way of promotion, but he had grown used to the very different mode in the corps. If a man had much in the way of influence, he was not an aviator, as a rule. Rankin himself was an exception, and Lawrence's former Lieutenant Ferris, the only two such cases Lawrence had so far met in the service. Merit, and the lucky opportunity of demonstrating it, had in practice by far the greater reach. Personal loyalties might have their impact, but Rankin did not know these men. They had not been affectionate towards him. He had met them one and all not a month ago. Lawrence had known the gesture was a futile one, but he had spoken anyway.
"Sir, you may not be aware that Captain Granby had other intentions," he had said quietly.
Rankin had rebuffed him in as offensive a way as possible, and without bothering to lower his voice, adding now,
"I do not intend this covert should be conducted on the irregular and unsound lines of your own model of behaviour."
"By which I can only suppose you mean that Mr. Forthing is not of a line of aviators," Lawrence said.
"Your own example must be all that any man requires to appreciate the value of a trained, a trusted lineage, of men who understand what dragons are and what their own duty is," Rankin said.
Temeraire, who had been anxiously watching the egg so far, lifted his head here and said,
"Well, if the egg should prefer Mr. Forthing, it may have him, and I will tell it so whether you like me to or not. I do not care whether he has a trusted lineage."
Rankin wheeled to confront him, but meanwhile the egg was rocking. It cracked abruptly across its equator, or near enough, and all their attention was drawn over to it at once. Tipping over, it did not quite separate. With an evident effort, the broken upper half was slowly pushed forward over the sand, furrowing up the burnt patches, and the hatchling beast crawled laboriously out. And there was a brief, dismayed silence as it raised its head. It was a strange, misshapen creature with none of the lithe, deadly grace that every other dragonette whom Lawrence had ever seen had possessed instantly on cracking the shell. It was a long, almost skeletal thing, uniformly mottled brown-grey, and bristling along all its shoulders and in patches over its back with spikes very like the barbs on the tails of the checkered nettle, one of which had produced the egg. It had also inherited the claws of its Parnassian sire, so long they bid fair to snag upon its own flesh. Its wings were a little stubby and badly cramped together, draped loosely over the hatchling's sides. But as it tried to stretch them out, those sides were revealed, distended into swollen folds which bulged out over the dragonette's shoulder and hip joints, as if its ribcage were shrunken in too small and the hide too large for it. Yet it was otherwise painfully thin to look upon, the bones of the shoulders and hips standing in sharp relief, long and narrow, and had been folded upon itself several times in the tight bounds of the shell. The dragonette had evidently suffered from the confinement, and moving palsied slow, unwound itself only a little at a time, and pausing every short while to gasp a few laboured breaths. Lawrence could only wince for its sake. It was scarcely the size of an underfed hound.
"Oh, I am hungry," the dragonette said, in a small piping voice which sounded very much as though it were being whistled through a reed.
But none of the aviators moved. Drewmore and Blinken shifted uneasily and looked at Forthing, who already had edged back away. They too stepped back from the hatchling, and a general uneasy silence began.
"Well," Rankin said after a pause, "it is a pity. Gentlemen, I assume you are one and all in agreement? There is no officer who would care to try the harnessing? Mr. Dorset?"
Dorset was already pacing around the hatchling, inspecting it. He shook his head absently.
"I cannot speak either to the source or the effects of the deformity until I have opened it, of course. From the laboured breathing, I should imagine the lungs are constrained. Quite an interesting case."
No one else spoke. Lawrence did not immediately follow until Rankin turned and said,
"Mr. Fellows, I believe you are our only ground crew master. I must ask you to undertake the duty. I am afraid we do not have rifles. Would you prefer a sledge or a pistol?"
Temeraire, Lawrence thought, had also not yet understood. Before he should realize, Lawrence said sharply,
"That is quite enough, sir. I wonder if you could have the temerity to call yourself a Christian. Mr. Fellows, we will have none of that."
Rankin wheeled on him and snapped,
"That you are ignorant of all principles of the Corps, and disdain those few you know, is no surprise. That you have the audacity to set yourself up as authority likewise. What can you, who received the privilege unlooked for and unearned, understand of the feelings of any aviator on such an occasion, who has lived all his life in waiting for it? It is our duty, as much our duty as harnessing the beast would be if it were fit for service. It is not. It is not, and there is nothing to be done for it."
"It is none the less one of God's creatures for its lack of usefulness," Lawrence said, "and I will not see it murdered."
"Would you prefer to see it abandoned and exposed, to suffer slowly?" Rankin said. "A dragon comes out of the shell, ready to fend for itself. Do you imagine this hatchling could do so if we should leave it here, unharnessed and alone?"
The dragonette, as yet mostly preoccupied with untangling itself, looked back at them, wary and uncertain. Fumbling its long clawed feet over one another and its tail, it tried to spread out its wings, and managed to flap and raise a little dust, but then it ceased the effort and fell to gasping instead.
"Oh," Temeraire said sadly to the hatchling, "you cannot fly?"
"I am sure I will manage it shortly,"
the hatchling said in its small, pale voice.
"Only I am so stiff and hungry."
Rankin jerked his hand cuttingly.
"It cannot live long in any case," he said.
"Then," Lawrence said, "we will give the poor beast some food, and what comfort it can take, until the natural end should come. If that be quick or late, that does not relieve us of the obligations of humanity."
"And who do you propose should feed it?" Rankin said. "No aviator will do it and so bind himself, sacrificing his one chance. And I will be damned if I will allow you to impose a low convict upon us with a claim to call himself captain."
"I will feed it myself," Lawrence said.
"What?"
Temeraire said, his head swinging around sharply. Lawrence paused, astonished, and Temeraire said,
"You would?"
And his voice was trembling, thrumming with distress and wrath, an edge of the resonance of the divine wind to it.
"Have done," Rankin said impatiently. "You cannot feed it. Unless it has no sense at all, it will not take food from your hands. It can see you are Temeraire's, and it knows he would kill it at once. Which," he added, "would save us the difficulty, I suppose."
Lawrence threw him a disgusted look.
Temeraire might perhaps dislike the gesture, but as for murdering a small and helpless hatchling, he did not in the least believe it. He said, "Temeraire, my dear, what is this absurdity? You cannot imagine I would propose any substitution, ever."
That Temeraire was distressed, however, was certain. Lawrence added,
"My intentions are only the most practical, and I beg you to feed the hatchling yourself if you should have any objection to my performing the office."
"Oh,"
Temeraire said, his ruff smoothing a little.
"Oh, well, I do not mind that, but, Lawrence,"
he leaned his head over and in a low and confiding tone said, rather hesitantly,
"Lawrence, maybe you have not quite understood. It cannot fly."
Lawrence was very much shocked. Shocked, appalled. He scarcely knew what to say. Rankin said,
"There, will this convince you to have done enacting us this thorough Cheltenham tragedy?"
Temeraire snorted at Rankin.
"I'm sure I do not see why you must speak if all you wish is to be unpleasant," he said. "And Lawrence, if you should feel very strongly, of course I will give the hatchling some food.
only it does seem a little strange.
More than a little strange, Caesar said. Why, what's it to do when you aren't about and it is hungry? Anyway, we are still in this desert, and it has been scraps and string all week. There may be a bit of extra food about now, but it's a long way back to the cows. You might have a little sense, instead of wasting it.
Perhaps it might come to be able to fly after all, Temeraire said, if it is only tired from being shaken a great deal, although then it might have stayed in the shell to rest.
He trailed off, not very convincingly, and Lawrence found himself abruptly unsure, adrift. What he had supposed a certain mooring had shifted, and was floating with him in an unknown current. If the hatchling should linger, deformed, helpless, without any means of sufficiency, rejected by the Corps and its fellows also.
"Temeraire, you will oblige me greatly if you would give it something," Lawrence said, nevertheless.
There was no alternative which did not appall the worse, which was not full of barbarism and cruelty, and must be rejected out of hand. He turned and stopped. The hatchling was feasting slowly but with great determination in the gutted innards of the kangaroo, with a loop of belt around its neck for token harness. And Domaine looked up and said,
"I am naming him Gulingile."